Hi, everyone, and welcome to another episode of the Product Coalition podcast, where today I am extremely excited to be joined by Braden Cowitz. Braden, welcome.
Jay, thanks for having me.
Absolute pleasure. I'm really looking forward to chatting through today. It's going to be good fun. For those that are tuning in, maybe for the first time, like many other podcasters out there, these sessions are remote. So some of the audio quality might not be what you're used to when you see my face-to-face sessions, but please bear with us doing the best we can in these remote circumstances. Now, if you've just discovered the Product Coalition, welcome. We're a global product community with over 500,000 readers, 7,000 Slack members, and thousands of podcast listeners. You can head to members.productcoalition.com to test what you've learned in every podcast episode and also to become a member. Braden, I'm really excited to have you on for a number of reasons, and I won't read them all out right now, what's going through my head. But firstly and foremostly is because I'm one of the few people, it feels like, in product management that came from a design background. And not an engineering background or analyst background. And so for me, I always enjoy these sessions with other people who just love design and everything to do with thinking about things in a design way. So I'm really glad to have you on the show. Thanks for joining me.
Yeah, of course.
So do you mind getting us going by giving us a bit about you for those that don't know the name Braden Cowitz? And the reason for that is I knew it, and I'm so glad, you know, when you reached out about the show. But do you mind giving a bit of background and history for the audience on yourself?
Sure. I guess I'll go chronological. So I was very, very lucky and managed to land a early design job at Google when they were only really hiring designers that had engineering degrees. And I happened to have a CS degree, but not much design experience. So I managed to land that job and then learned a lot with the design team that was there and got the chance to work on a lot of the first versions of Google products, like not search and not ads, but all sorts of other stuff like Gmail and Google Docs, Google Trends. And was just kind of able to bounce around between a lot of these new teams that were starting up and launching things. And so it was just such a privilege to be able to be there at that time. And then as I was, Google kind of had an interesting relationship with product management and engineering and design. And I think in the early days, design was definitely in kind of a tinier box of like, you are responsible for when we've decided this is what the product should do. How should the screen look? That is the boundary between the product manager and the designer. And I wanted to do more. I wanted to have more impact than just taking a flow spec'd out and wireframed and starting to draw it. So I was looking for something else, and Google Ventures was just getting started. So then I also like totally lucked into that. I used some of my 20% time, which was at Google, you could kind of do whatever you wanted to do. And I went and advised some startups that Google Ventures had just started to invest in. And one of them was an ad company. And I suggested they make their links blue and underlined. And they wrote back to their investors at GV and said, this guy's a genius. Our click-through rates are through the roof. And so that was the easiest advice I ever gave. But I landed a job at Google Ventures and for 7 years helped startups understand what design is, hire design teams, operate design within their companies. And it was kind of starting around this time when I think CEOs had seen Apple be successful and they knew design was important. They were thinking, design, I got to have that. That's a critical ingredient, but I don't really know what it is. Like, I'm not really sure what it means. I've never hired a designer before. So at the beginning, it was kind of working with teams at that level. And at the end, people were asking questions around like, how do I structure a 30-person design team? And so seeing design kind of grow up within the startup community during that time was super interesting. And then 3 years ago, I started a company with some friends called Range, and we make software that helps teams work better together, even when they're working remote. Happy to go into more about what we do there, but that's roughly my background. I should probably also mention, while we were at Google Ventures and building the design team there, we popularized the design sprint methodology and wrote a book about it. And a lot of that was to help teams understand what design is by doing design. And also happy to chat about design sprints if you want.
Awesome. Awesome. Yeah. So that's the moment when you entered my life, although you wouldn't have known it, sort of, it must be 4 or 5 years ago now, and introduced the world to those design sprints and that the blue bottle talk I remember seeing. And yes, a really, really sort of super excited to jump into some concepts today around leadership, teams, maybe design as well. And see how we go. So you mentioned Range there very briefly, and you started that journey 3 years ago. Could you share a little bit more around what was the idea there, and what's the last 3 years of, you know, solving a meaningful problem been like at Range?
Yeah, I mean, the idea at the beginning was realizing that teams often struggle to know what's happening, you know, particularly as organizations get bigger and grow. Managers often wonder, like, they often feel like I should know what my team is doing, but really I don't. And the best ways maybe to do it are to drive by people's desks and ask. And they wonder, I want to help people when they're stuck, but I don't always know when people are stuck. And then we would also hear the similar questions from individuals, like, I want to know what other teams in my company are doing, but I often don't know. Or I often work with lots of different teams and it's hard to stay in sync with them. So we got inspiration from the engineering community who had been doing these kind of stand-up practices where you get in the room every day and you talk about, you know, what you're planning to do and what you've done and where you're blocked. And then you have a moment to really get to know each other as people. But that is, to be honest, quite laborious. It's hard to get everyone on the same schedule working in different time zones. It's hard as your company grows to talk to designers and they're like, I work with the design team and two product teams, so I'm in three stand-ups a day. I'm like, and you have to do design work. It's like, it's very hard as your company grows to have those moments of connection and understanding and communication. So we took inspiration there and then decided to build a product that moved all of that online and helps people get to know each other, know what's happening, know where people are blocked, and just do that all asynchronously so it's easy. And along with that, we built all these connections to other different tools. So the other thing we realized is that when people start their day, you know, at least for me, I kind of have a wide skill set. So I've got issues in GitHub that have been assigned to me. I've got stuff in Asana. I've got an inbox that's full. My task list is spread across a bunch of different tools. And so Range becomes a place for me to see what's happening across all those tools and then share that with my team.
Awesome. Now, do you mind telling me, I'm really keen to hear, you know, you come from that world of so many years at Google with design and the GV design and then the design sprints. How did you apply what had been preached and everything that gets talked about with like design sprints and design thinking and human-centered design? What did you do at Range to apply some of that stuff that gets so often talked about, but not everyone sort of shares what goes on under the hood to actually prove out that this is going to make someone's, in this instance, morning a lot easier and a lot less confronting by jumping into five different tools before 9 a.m.
Yeah. You know, I was thinking about that, like thinking about improv and jazz recently around, you know, people typically don't learn how to improv by just sitting around and messing around. They learn the classics and they learn, you know, they learn set songs. And then from that base of understanding, then they have the freedom to improvise. And I feel like that type of growth is often true, you know, in all sorts of other fields. So when I think of the design sprint, you know, I think of it as a toolkit that is very much packaged and goes all the way from the beginning to all the way to the end. And you use it in some particular situations and you'll get some particular outcome, but it's a big hefty tool. It's like going to your tool shed and pulling out like the biggest hunk of tool. But like, you don't always need that. Like, the better you get in your career and the more you understand things, the more you can reach for smaller hand tools and use them, not with a process, but when it feels about right, when you think you're in that need. And that has been my experience at Range, that we, you know, in moments where we feel like we need to know more about customers, we'll go and do some research and talk to them and bring back the data and do some synthesis with the team. In moments where we feel like we know what the customers need, but we need to, you know, think about what we're building next, we'll use elements from the sprint process or you know, other brainstorm elements to pull those ideas out of the team and kind of synthesize them and prioritize. So remarkably, over the past 3 years, I haven't run a single sprint at my own company. But I think that may change too. Like, one of the values of a sprint that I heard from a lot of people were that it just gave them time away from all the other demands to think about a hard problem. And I think particularly and this is what I heard also just from designers I knew that worked at IDEO, they're like, the secret is that we just get a bunch of smart people and they actually think about a problem without any distractions for a while. Like, there are other things that they do, but like, that is a huge part of the recipe. And so in some ways, the sprint is a a structure, an excuse to have a bunch of people really sit down and think about a hard problem together. I have not found that to be a challenge in our company. We're about a dozen people. At some scale, I think we will, you know, inevitably. And then tools like the Sprint will become more applicable.
Nice. Can I ask, is everyone at Range, is it a fully remote organization? Are you all sort of sharing time zones, geography, or offices?
Yeah.
Obviously,
tired of we got rid of our office recently. Our lease came up and it was, everyone is working from home now. Right. But we started the transition to remote much earlier, having employees in different states. But I think at the moment, everyone's in the same time zone, although we're loosening that as well.
Right. Okay. For some managers, having a remote team is new. What changes would you recommend managers think about making? You know, I mean, it's been like a slap in the face for many that just happened. And now they're standing back and taking a breath. And at time of recording this, depending on where you are in the world, nearly everyone in the world's been in lockdown anywhere between sort of 8 to 12 weeks. So, you know, what advice would you give those that are facing that or finding it hard just working remote and managing a team?
Yeah, I mean, it has been like a slap in the face. I feel like for the first couple of weeks there, for a lot of the people I talked to, it was sort of like, you know, grit through it. We're just like, maybe we'll all go back to work in a month. And so we just got to like deal with this dysfunction and this challenge for, you know, a couple of weeks and then it'll go back to normal. And I think it's just becoming clear as offices close and the timeline of this pandemic is becoming clear that this is not a situation that you can kind of suffer through. It's a time when we need to grow and we need to start building capabilities to work remote. And so I think people are through that initial reaction and now they're really starting to look for ways that they can grow as a team and be remote. But I mean, maybe even like more so outside the remote is just to realize the situation that we're in right now that I oftentimes think about the capacity that people have, you know, like a cup filling over. So you might go in the morning and ask someone like, how's that project going? And they just explode at you. Like, I can't believe you asked me. I got a million things on my plate. And you're like, whoa, like where did that come from? And oftentimes when that's happening, what you're not seeing is their cup sort of filling up. So like They were up all night with their kids screaming and then they biked to work and a car almost ran them over. And then they got in and three more people asked them about what's going on with projects. And then you asked them and their cup spilled over and you saw that kind of emotional outburst. And so when I think about, you know, the members of teams now, like our cups are like, you know, the world is in a very tumultuous place right now and our cups are kind of always at half full. And so that means that our capacity for doing work is reduced. And as a manager, I think you have to start with that reality. Like if you started a team and you said, well, okay, we've just laid off half the people. Now everyone else has to work twice as hard. You would never do that. Like you would realize that we now have less capacity and that's going to change all sorts of other things about how we run this team. And I think first of all, in this moment, we have to recognize that everyone's running out of reduced capacity. Mm. I think it's probably somewhere between 20% reduced to 50% reduced or more on average across teams. And so as managers, just like that is the reality. And now adjust what you expect and how you're going to work. But I think within that framework as well, there's different types of capacity that people have. So there's this book, An Everyone Culture, where they talk about deliberatively developmental organizations, which is just a mouthful. but the framework I like in there is Home Edge Groove. When they talk about, I don't think they specifically talk about capacity, but I often think about it in that way, where home is the element where you feel safe on a team. It's psychological safety. It's feeling like, you know, you're worthwhile and a part of the team and have that belonging. Groove is the processes that we want run, where we really feel like we know what's expected, we know how to work together and we're doing it. And edge is where we're pushed to our limits, where we're making mistakes, where we're problem solving. And, you know, these three elements of being on a team are often, they relate to each other, right? But you can also kind of think about it as capacity, like people's capacity for edge right now. Like we've already used up that capacity, to be honest. Like we're learning how to work from home. You know, kids are running everywhere in the house as we're trying to focus. And, you know, we're dealing with scary times in the world with the pandemic and our families. And so, okay, so the edge cup is full. Yep. So now as a manager, we think like, okay, what types of work can we get done as a team really leaning on Home and Groove? How can we make people feel a sense of belonging, feel safe? And how can we sort of build processes where people feel productive and can get stuff done? So we're not pushing people to grow in professional ways as much now, because we're already growing in a lot of other ways and struggling.
Yeah, nice, nice. Along with capacity, I know that I've certainly felt, you know, Monday this week was an example where I think about capacity in terms of like an engine. The bigger the engine, the faster the car can go, and capacities drop down. But for me, waking up Monday and seeing, for instance, the riots that happened in London over the weekend, and there's some sort of emotional burden. And that, to be honest, I couldn't even get out of second and third gear. So it was nothing to do with necessarily time or too much on or too stressed. There was just this emotional drained feeling. And I don't know if it's psychological safety in a sort of more of a meta, how the world is making me feel. But it's certainly, just emotionally held me back. Although I had all of the time, I had my day planned, I had all my calendars, blocked out of what I'm going to get through today. But there's things like that at the moment that just seem to be, for anyone, any type of employee or person out there, you can wake up and a news article is yet another slap in the face that you're just not expecting. And it's really hard. So
if there's a silver lining to this, I think it's that so many people are going through that exact experience that you mentioned together, and that we can talk about that stuff, because it's not limited to just this moment in time. I remember back when I was fundraising, I'd have a morning meeting and maybe it didn't go so well. So you're putting your heart on your sleeve and talking about the company and the vision you want to see. And maybe the VC is like checking their phone and eating lunch. And so after that, oftentimes I would come back to the office and just be deflated. Yes, I've got the task list. Yes, in theory, I'm like well rested, but it was really hard sometimes to recover from that emotionality in the morning. And that's a thing that maybe you feel shame over, or like you don't feel like you can talk about, or that you feel like you're alone in experiencing. But these are very human moments. They're very human experiences. And I'm hoping that because we're all going through them now, we have more understanding that these things affect people, and people are going to have very productive days, and then people are going to have very low days. And that's what it means to be human.
Nice, nice. So psychological safety, I was introduced to through, I think it was Project Aristotle at Google back in the day. But for those that are new to that term, what does that mean to you and to the team at Range?
Yeah, I think a little bit about like different types of teams. So, there's a golf team and a basketball team. And I'm not much of a sports person, but even me, I'm like, okay, the golf people are all playing individually and summing up their points. And then the basketball team, that is a very different kind of team. And oftentimes when we think about what we want our teams to be, it looks a lot more like the basketball team. It's about helping each other out, and it's about creating something together that's more than just the sum. So in that definition, then you have to ask yourself, if a team is helping each other out, how do we get to the point where we're really helping each other? Well, then we have to be able to ask for help. And if we're asking for help, we're admitting that we don't know something or can't do something well. We have to be vulnerable in order to do that. So then you start to see this connection between like the ability to be vulnerable in front of each other, and how that leads to being able to ask for help, and how that leads to being able to create things that are greater than the sum of all of our work. So that foundation of vulnerability is the thing that makes high performing teams. One of a couple core ingredients. And so Brené Brown writes a lot about this. I highly recommend reading her work, but we spend some time at Range like thinking about how we start to build this, particularly over remote. And honestly, one of the best ways I've found to do it is that at the start of every meeting, we do kind of an opening round. And at the end of every meeting, we do kind of a closing round. And that is a moment for people to just check in and say how they're doing, and then check in and talk about the experience of that meeting for them. And I've sort of been thinking about it like offsites, like sometimes every 6 months or every year, your team will do a big offsite and you try to cram in that culture moment in that little time. This way of doing it it kind of spreads that in little 5-minute increments at the, you know, throughout your experience working together. And I just find it so much more effective. Like, I think sometimes managers think, well, we have to be super efficient. We can't talk about anything else. We got to get in the meeting and get right down to business. But the reality is that we have to know each other as human beings and feel vulnerable in front of each other as human beings in order to talk about the hard work that's happening.
Right. Okay. Can I ask, because that is almost a pattern by the sounds of it with regards to how you work, has that pattern and cadence and rhythm of, because it's always a thing that you always do as a team, made it easier, I suppose, particularly for maybe new team members that join or similar?
Yeah, it's interesting. I was reflecting on this that, you know, we have a range, we have a lot of ways that we run meetings and spend time together that are very particular. And I think that means that our culture, our how we work together, our habits are intentionally designed, but it can be sometimes overwhelming for someone to step in and not quite realize how we bring up meeting topics and how we manage them and how we close them out and move on to the next sections, a particular way that we do that. And so it can be a little bit of a learning curve for new people, but it also, I think, gives them an opportunity, particularly these kind of closing and opening rounds, to start to see their coworkers as people, not just as bosses or reports or cogs in a machine, but as human beings that are going through all sorts of other stuff in their life.
Nice, nice. Do you mind me asking, you know, if you think about a day in the life of you, how many hours are on video calls for you at the right now with what's going on?
It's a good balance. Some days, like yesterday, it was about half the day. Right. And some days I don't have any meetings at all. Right. One of the things that we've done to organize our work to work remotely is to really think carefully about the types of communications that need to happen during a cadence. So we work on a 2-week cadence. And then within that, we kind of think about what information needs to move across the team, what conversations need to happen across the team, and what kind of moments of connection do we want to have as a team. And so in that framework, it's you know, if you list all those things out, you might be like, information, okay, well, we need to know what's happening with, you know, OKRs, objectives. We need to know who's working on what, who's blocked. For conversations, it's you know, we're planning something. We have to figure out how this thing works. And it's not just like transmitting one way. It's really a back and forth that you're trying to get. And for moments of connection, that's really has to be in person. So each one of those kind of almost implies how you should manage that. So like information, a status update. Let's say we get in a meeting and I run you through a slide deck. Depending on who you are, that slide deck may be too fast or too slow. Maybe you're really good at marketing metrics and you're like, oh, go faster. Maybe you're really slow at marketing metrics. Usually doing informational stuff in person is it's just boring for half the team and really feels like a waste of time. Conversations actually too seems to be kind of more of a balance where sometimes you want that in-person time, but we actually often try to move most of our conversations into like documents where we're talking about a plan, putting it into a concrete artifact, and then using that document to drive conversation asynchronously on top of. And then moments of connection really should be over video or audio. They're the moments where you feel like you can really connect to the people around you. And so I kind of use that framework of like information, conversation, and connection to kind of think about where we want to spend our time in person and where we want to spend our time asynchronously. And because we've designed that intentionally at Range, I feel like we don't have too many meetings. Where I hear people like definitely getting the Zoom fatigue, yeah, is from places where they haven't figured out how to move more of that type of work over into the asynchronous realm.
Yeah, and that's why I asked, you know, I think it's you're you know, a co-founder, a CEO of the company, you know, you're in a leadership position, you've got a lot of things maybe to worry about. And I hear from product managers quite often at the moment that they're on Zoom calls all day. And what I like is what you've expressed there with regards to a framework, how to think about, well, maybe you could have less video calls, and the video calls you do have are more specific to a connecting type outcome as opposed to purely sharing information and updates. So thank you for sharing that. I think that's going to be really valuable to the audience.
Of course, yeah. I should correct you though. My co-founder Dan is the CEO, and I'm very thankful for that. He does a wonderful job, and I'm really grateful he's our CEO.
Brilliant. So with managers adapting to remote, you mentioned around things can get stressful and communication can become overwhelming. Is there, for someone who's currently smashing out, let's say 50 hours a week, they've also trying to, you know, got maybe a bit of homeschooling going on. They're overwhelmed with just 6-7 hours of video calls a day while still got the work to do, etc., and working maybe across long time zones. Where do you think they could start with change to make that day a little bit easier?
I think you have to realize that taking care of yourself enables you to take care of the people around you, right? So if I don't take care of myself, I don't do a great job at taking care of my family and my friends. And if my friends aren't there to support me as well, then I don't do a good job at taking care of the broader community of the people at work and then the even broader community of our customers. So it's interesting how these things kind of layer on themselves and create the foundation for the other work that we do that's broader out in the world. So, you know, for people that are feeling overwhelmed, I would suggest to take a little bit of time and think about how you can take care of yourself first, because it is the way that you do your best work at taking care of other people. But I think there's also like, I don't know. It's always hard when there's too much to do. You know, I think we experienced this at a startup as well. It's maybe a thing you struggle with all in your career, because there's always more to do than there is a team to do it or time to get it done.
Nice.
I honestly struggle with that a fair amount. And so I'm not sure I have great, like, really quick one-liner sage advices for how to deal with that particular tension.
All right. The world of design, and for designers that are now working remotely, I'm really keen to hear with so much depth and background of different design tactics you've used over time. And so many of them may have been face-to-face with validating ideas or inquiry, etc. For the remote designer that now has to both research and or test purely in a remote world, what are some of the changes you'd recommend for them to not be sort of overwhelmed by that?
Yeah, I was thinking back at Google Ventures, I worked with Michael Margolis, who's a researcher, and he had switched to mostly remote interviews way before any of this happened. So I think user research actually works fine remote, and it's sometimes almost better because you can access a wider set of people. And so you can often get your targeting on who you want to talk to better. In terms of how designers collaborate, I mean, we're just so lucky we have things like Figma now where we didn't before, where we can all look and point at the same things. I think there's something really powerful about the noun and the verb. The, like, I point at something and that's the noun, and then I say something and that's the verb. Like that is something that's magical about in-person communication, where I can say, what do you think about this? And we can use our visual system and our auditory system to communicate across both of those bands. And that's usually one of the big things that drops off when we go online. We just have to do audio. We can't point at things anymore. So I love jamming on in Figma with people. Another thing I might suggest is I did this trick at Google back in the day. I would just record a lot of screencasts, like really quick, fast screencasts. Maybe that was for a bug report where I could show the bug, prove to an engineer that it was really real, and then put some emotional content in there about how much it sucked that bug existed. And that screenshot, that kind of bundle, ended up being a lot more effective at having people pay attention to the user experience bugs than just, you know, a ticket in Jira. Same thing for explaining my designs. I'll often like do a quick screencast and click through them and talk through it and share that out. So that's not quite as good as being in the same room as someone, but again, it's that noun and verb thing. It's me being able to say, oh yeah, and then you just click here and see this thing. And sometimes you want to do this and you click, 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 and you can do it. Like, that's a very hard thing to communicate with like a red line spec or a bunch of screenshots, but it's much, much easier to do with the power of narrative with a video.
Yeah, nice. And I think the full remote situation is forcing that more often. I know not only did I run a design sprint about 2 months ago, fully remote. But more recently, coming out of some user testing, it was like 4 hours of user testing. I wanted to synthesize what was going through my head in the moment. Mm-hmm. But the first time, I just hit record on the camera and just recorded a session to the team. Hi team, you've seen I've just ended session 5. Just wrapped up the day. Look, here's my notes. This is just my emotional response to the user testing today. We'll go through the insights and synthesis next week. But I just want to share with you guys what I'm thinking and feeling based upon 5 hours with customers. And that was so well received, and people found it so easy to just consume a video. I didn't have to write a big email. There was no big presentation. They got to see my body language, the emotion in my voice of what I felt was working, what wasn't, etc. And that's not something I've ever thought about doing when I've been in an office, when it's like, oh, I'll wait till I see them at 4 o'clock and then I'll give them an update. And then there's a corridor conversation on Monday around what happened in user testing last Friday. And so I certainly see my patterns of communication are changing.
Yeah, I think it's a really nice technique. I will try to use that more. And I was just reflecting as you're talking about how teams worked maybe 10, 20 years ago, and then how they work today and how they'll work in the future. One of the biggest things I've learned as I've kind of dove into Range and dove into learning how teams work is that it has not been static. Like, early organizations looked much more like militaries. And then we had the Industrial Revolution, and organizations looked like that, where we really treated people as a part of a machine. And now we're in kind of a different era of how organizations come together and how we work. And in each of those phases, we've had very different ways that we communicate and work together. And so however static it feels like in this moment, like nothing will ever change, we're all going to be stuck in Slack forever, like, I think it will. I think what you just described of having a moment where people can create content that is authentic and emotional, and then people can consume it asynchronously in whatever time zone they're in, and you can still have that moment. Like, that may be somewhat rare today, but in 10 years, that might be like, of course, that's like the primary way we talk to each other. I mean, who knows?
Yeah, absolutely. And to be honest, even my 5-year-old daughter now communicates on, she's got a little iPad for a birthday, a little mini one. Uh-huh. And so now she sends voice messages to the grandparents because she's too young to read and type. So she knows how to record a message, say what she's been up to that day, and send it to the grandparents. And the grandparents now send a voice message back. So completely bypassing the time it takes to type to share that message. And so when I think about her entering the workforce in 15 to 20 years, these are just completely acceptable, culturally acceptable, more than anything, patterns that we all move forward with.
Absolutely, yeah.
This has been an awesome session. Thank you so much, Braden. I really enjoyed chatting through quite some varied topics here today. I really appreciate it.
Yeah, thank you very much for having me. I also enjoyed the conversation. It was great.
Absolute pleasure. Absolute pleasure. For those listening, I hope you've enjoyed another Product Coalition podcast. I certainly have enjoyed my time today with Braden, and I could certainly talk around a whole range of historical experiences he's had and dig deep into those as well. I hope you've enjoyed this episode. If you want to catch more episodes or find out more about Product Coalition, you can do so over at members.productcoalition.com. Until the next episode, take care. Bye-bye.